we tried to downplay. Instead, we drank as we usually did, a bit past buzzed, all except Danny, whose slowdown switch had flipped to the on position. He got the call a little past 11. I have no idea how he even heard the ring over the noise in the bar, but he did, and after glancing at the screen, he got up from the table and went outside. We thought nothing about it. Why would we? Nor did we consider it a miss when he walked past our table after coming back inside and made a beeline for the bar. I watched him wedge himself between some people, vying for the bartender's attention. It took a few minutes before he received his drink, but when he turned, I saw that he'd ordered a cocktail, a very tall glass of something golden brown. He wandered off toward another area of the bar, as if he'd forgotten us entirely. Of everyone there, I was probably his closest friend, so I followed him. By then, he was leaning against the wall near the restroom. As I approached, he took a huge swallow from his glass, finishing nearly a third of its contents. "What do you have there?" I asked. "Bourbon." "Wow, that's a pretty big glass." "I told him to fill it," he said. "Did I miss the contest where Pabst got second place, not first?" It wasn't particularly funny, and I don't know why I said it. Other than that, the way he was acting was making me nervous. "It's what my dad drinks," he said. For the first time, I noticed his shell-shocked expression. Not the effect of alcohol. Something else. "Are you okay?" I asked. He took another long drink. By then, the glass was half empty. It had to be at least 4, maybe 5 shots. Danny was going to be drunk, maybe very drunk, in a very short while. "No," he said. "I'm not okay." "What happened?" "Who called?" "My mom," he said. "It was my mom who called." He pinched the bridge of his nose. "She just told me my dad died."
"Your dad?"
"He was in a car accident. She found out just a few minutes ago. Someone from Highway Patrol came by the house."
"That's awful," I said, truly at a loss for words.
Is there anything I can do? Can I bring you to your place?"
"She's getting me a ticket to fly home tomorrow. I don't know what I'm going to do about finals, though. Will they let me retake them next week?"
"I don't know, but that's the last thing you should be thinking about right now. Is your mom okay?" It took him a long time to answer. Instead, he seemed to be staring into the distance.
"No," he said. He gulped at his drink, finishing it. "She's not. I need to sit down."
"Sure," I said. "Let's go." I led him back to the table. Despite the alcohol he'd consumed, he didn't seem affected at all. Instead, he sat quietly, adding nothing to the conversation. He didn't mention the death of his father to anyone else at the table, and an hour later, I drove him back to his apartment. He went home on Sunday, just as he'd told me he would. And though we were friends, I never saw or heard from him again.
"Hold on," Marge said.
After dropping London off at school on Tuesday morning, she'd come straight to my house where we sat at the kitchen table.
"So she just left?"
"Last night," I said.
"Did she at least say she was sorry?"
"I don't remember." I shook my head. "I can't even, I couldn't keep my thoughts straight. My roiling emotions, shock and fear, disbelief and anger, had me veering from one extreme to the next. Though I knew I'd done it, I couldn't remember driving London to school only a few minutes earlier. The drive had been consigned to nothingness.
"Your hands are shaking," Marge said.
"Yeah, I'm okay." Trailing off, I took a long breath.
"Shouldn't you be at work?
I can scramble up some eggs." Marge would tell me later that I got up from the table and went to the fridge. As soon as I pulled it open, I must have decided I needed coffee instead. I went to the coffee cabinet and then realized I should probably get cups out for Marge and me first. But I must have thought I still needed coffee, so I set the cups beside the coffee maker. She watched as I went to the fridge and pulled out the eggs before returning them to the same location. She said I then wandered to the pantry and came out with a bowl and...
"How about I make breakfast?" she suggested, rising from the table.
"Huh?"
"Have a seat."
"Don't you need to go to work?"
"I've decided that I'm taking the day off."
She reached for her cell phone.
Sit down. I'll be back in a minute. I just have to tell my boss.
As I took my seat, I was struck anew by the realization that Vivian had left me, that she was in love with her boss. She was gone. I watched Marge open the door to the back patio. Where are you going?
I'm going to call my boss.
Why are you calling your boss? Marge stayed with me all day. She picked up London from school and also brought her to and from her piano lesson. Liz came by after her last appointment, and together they not only made dinner, but kept London entertained and helped her get ready for bed. It wasn't often that her aunties came by to play, and London was over the moon by the extra attention. Again, it would be Marge who would tell me this. Like the drive to school, I wouldn't be able to remember it. The only thing I really remember was watching the clock and waiting for Vivian to call. Something she never did. The next morning, after sleeping less than 3 hours, I crawled out of bed feeling almost hungover, with all my nerves on edge. It was a monumental effort to shower and shave, something I'd neglected the day before. Nor had I eaten much, only a few bites at breakfast and dinner. But the thought of food was inconceivable. Marge handed me a cup of coffee as soon as I entered the kitchen, then started loading a plate.
"Take a seat," she said. "You need something in your stomach."
"What are you doing here?"
"What does it look like? I came by this morning to make sure you had something to eat."
"I didn't hear you knock."
"I didn't," she said. "After you went to bed, I borrowed your house key. I hope you don't mind."
"It's fine," I said. Raising the mug, I took a sip, but the coffee tasted wrong, off somehow. Despite the tantalizing aromas, my stomach remained knotted. Nonetheless, I pulled out my chair at the table and plopped down. She set a plate in front of me, piled high with eggs, bacon, and toast.
"I don't think I can eat," I offered. "Too bad," she said. "You're going to eat even if I have to tie you to the chair and feed you myself."
Too worn out to argue, I forced down a few bites. Strangely, every bite seemed a little easier than the last, but I still finished less than half of it.
"She left me."
"I know," Marge said. "She didn't want to try to work it out."
"I know."
"Why? What did I do wrong?" Marge took a puff from her inhaler, buying time, and fully aware that casting blame or heaping criticism on Vivian would only heighten my emotional turmoil.
"I don't think you did anything wrong. It's just that relationships are hard, and both people have to want them to work."
As true as the statement was, I felt no relief when she said it.
"Are you sure you don't want me to stay with you today?" Marge asked.
"I can't ask you to take another day off," I said. Eating seemed to have had a mildly stabilizing effect on my emotional state. I still wasn't great, mind you, not even close. The emotional surges may not have been the tidal waves of yesterday, but they were still in the rogue wave category, the kind that sank the Andrea Gale in the film The Perfect Storm. I felt wildly off balance, but hoped that I could still handle the basics. Get London to school and back. Dance class. Order pizza for dinner. I knew I wouldn't have the mental or emotional energy for anything else. Even reading the paper or vacuuming were way beyond my capabilities. My goal was simply to stay upright and take care of my daughter. Marge didn't seem convinced.
"I'm going to call and check on you today. More than once."
"Okay," I agreed. But I knew there was part of me that was afraid to be alone. What if I simply broke into pieces as soon as she left? Or shattered, like the rest of my world? Vivian had left me. She was in love with someone else. I was a terrible husband, worthless. And I had failed. I disappointed her one too many times, and now I was alone. "Oh my God," I thought, as soon as Marge closed the door behind her. "I'm alone. I'm going to end up dying alone." While London was at school, I walked. I paced from one end of the house to the other and back again. I walked the streets of my neighborhood for hours. Questions about Vivian smashed into one another like endless battering rams. Was she in Atlanta or in another city? Was she taking the day off to set up the apartment or at the office? I wondered what she was doing. I imagined her using an earpiece as she spoke on the phone in a corner office, or hurrying down the hall carrying a stack of papers, the office I envisioned shifting from sleek and modern to stuffy and formal.
I wondered whether Spannerman was with her. I wondered whether she was laughing beside him or at her desk with her head in her hands. I checked my cell phone constantly, hoping to hear from her, watching for texts or missed calls. I brought the phone everywhere. I wanted to hear her voice telling me that she'd made a mistake and that she wanted to come home. I wanted her to tell me that she still loved me. I wanted her to ask me to forgive her, and in my heart, I knew that I wouldn't hesitate. I still loved her. The thought of life without her was incomprehensible. All the while, I continued to wonder what I had done wrong. Was it quitting my job? Was it that I'd gained a little weight? Was it that I had worked too much prior to quitting my job? And when did things start going wrong? When did I become disposable? How could she leave us? How could she leave London? Did Vivian intend to take her to Atlanta? The final question was the worst of all, too much to contemplate, and after finally returning to the house, I was exhausted. I knew I should nap, but as soon as I lay down, my mind began to race. Marge called 3 times, and I realized I had yet to tell my parents what had happened, but I still didn't want to believe it. I wanted this to be a dream. In mid-afternoon, I picked up London while my internal storm continued to rage. She asked for ice cream, and though the request felt impossibly taxing, I somehow made it to Dairy Queen. I also somehow got her to dance class on time. I went for a walk while London was at class. I'm not a strong man. I paced to the end of the strip mall. When I reached it, tears had begun to blur my vision, and all at once, I was standing by myself, with shoulders heaving, my face in my hands.
"When's Mommy coming home?"
London asked me. There was a box of pizza on the table, and I set my slice of pizza aside. I'd finished half of it. "I don't know, sweetheart. I haven't talked to her," I said. "But as soon as I find out, I'll let you know." If she thought my answer odd, she didn't show it.
"Did I tell you that Bodie and me found a baby turtle at recess?"
"A baby turtle?"
"We were playing freeze tag, and I found it over by the fence, and he was so cute. And then Bodie came over, and he thought it was really cute, too. We tried to feed it grass, but it wasn't hungry. And then all the other kids came over, and the teacher came over, too. And we asked if we could put it in a box and bring it into the classroom, and the teacher said yes."
"That sounds exciting."
"It was. She got a pencil box, and she put the turtle in it. And then we all walked with her while she brought it into the classroom. I think the turtle was scared because it kept trying to get out, but it couldn't because the box was too slippery on the sides. And then we wanted to name it, but the teacher said that we probably shouldn't because she was going to let it go."
"She didn't want to keep it?"
"She said that it probably missed its mommy."
I felt a lump in my throat. "Yeah, that makes sense."
"But me and Bodie named him anyway. We decided to call him Ed."
"Ed, the turtle?"
"We also thought about calling him Marco."
"How do you know it's a boy turtle?"
"We just know."
"Oh," I said, and despite the torment of the last couple of days, I found myself smiling. It didn't last. While I was putting the remains of the pizza into Ziploc bags, Vivian called. When I saw her photograph on the screen of my phone, my heart suddenly hammered in my chest. London was in the family room watching television, and I stepped out the kitchen door onto the back patio. I steeled myself before connecting the call. "Hey there," I said, trying to sound like everything was normal between us when actually nothing was normal at all. "How are you?" She hesitated.
"I'm okay. How are you?"
"It's been a little strange here," I said, "but I'm holding up. Where are you now?" She seemed to debate whether or not to answer.
"I'm in Tampa," she finally admitted. "Is London around or is she already in the bath?"
"No, not yet. She's in the family room."
"Can I talk to her?"
I steadied my breathing. "Before I put her on the phone, don't you think we should talk?"
"I'm not sure that's a good idea, Russ."
"Why not?"
"Because I don't know what you want me to say."
"What I want you to say?" I repeated. "I want you to give us another chance, Vivian." I ignored the deafening silence on her end. "I still feel like I don't know what's really going on. How can we make this work? We can go to counseling." Her voice was tight.
"Please, Russ. Can I just talk to London? I miss her."
"Don't you miss me? Or are you with Walter right now?" The thought came unbidden, bringing with it the image of my wife calling from a hotel suite,
Walter watching television in an adjoining area, and it was all I could do to step back inside the house and call to my daughter. Your mom's on the phone, London. She wants to say hi. I couldn't help but eavesdrop on the conversation, even when London wandered toward the family room. I heard her tell Vivian about her day. She also told Vivian about the turtle, and say, I love you. I heard her ask when Vivian was coming home. Though I didn't hear the answer, I could tell by London's expression that she didn't much like the answer.
Okay, Mommy, she eventually said. I miss you too. We can talk tomorrow.
Vivian knew I generally turned my phone to airplane mode when I went to bed, and old habits dying hard, I did so again that night. In the morning after turning it back on, I saw that Vivian had left two voicemails.
I know you wanted to talk, and we will, but only when we're both ready. I don't know what else I can tell you. I want you to know that I didn't plan for this to happen, and I know how much I've hurt you. I wish it wasn't this way, but I don't want to lie to you either. I'm mainly calling about London. Right now it's insanely busy at work with the transition, and Walter's pack and all the traveling. We still have the DC leg and we're flying up to New York this weekend. And since I'm traveling so much, it's probably best if London stays with you for a while. I want to get settled in here first and get her room set up, but I haven't had time to start either of those things. Anyway, I think it's important that you don't tell London what's going on yet. She's already stressed with school, and I know she's got to be exhausted. Besides, I think this is something we should do together. Hold on. Let me call you right back. I don't want your voicemail to cut me off.
The second voicemail picked up where she'd left off.
I spoke with a counselor today about the best way to tell London, and she said we should stress that we think it's best if we just live apart for a while, without mentioning separation or divorce. And obviously we should both emphasize that it doesn't have anything to do with her, and that we both love her. Anyway, we can discuss it more in person, but I wanted to let you know that I'm trying to do what's best for London. We'll also have to talk about when it might be a good time for her to come to Atlanta. She paused. Okay, I think that's it. Have a good day.
Have a good day? Was she kidding? Sitting on the edge of the bed, I replayed the voicemails several times. I think I was searching for something, anything, to suggest that she still cared about me in the slightest. But if it was there, I didn't hear it. I heard a lot of what she wanted, cloaked in terms that were ostensibly all about London's well-being, and the subterfuge infuriated me. While I was thinking about it, my cell phone rang. Hey there, Marge said, her tone sympathetic. Just calling to check in on you. It's not even 7 in the morning.
I know, but I was thinking about you.
I'm kind of angry, actually.
Yeah?
Vivian left a couple of messages, I said. I paraphrased as best I could.
Oh boy. That's what she woke up to? Not exactly a cup of delicious coffee, is it? Speaking of which, I'm on your street and about to pull in your driveway. Unlock your front door.
I left the bedroom and padded downstairs. By the time I got the door open, Marge was already getting out of the car, holding a pair of styrofoam cups. Watching her walk up the drive, I noted she was already dressed for work.
I can make coffee here, I said. I know, but I wanted to lay my eyeballs on you. Did you get any sleep last night?
Maybe 4 or 5 hours.
I didn't sleep much either.
Liz keeping you up late?
No, she said. Just worried about you. Let's go inside. Is London up yet?
Not yet.
How about I get her ready while you enjoy your coffee?
I'm not incompetent.
I know, she said. Actually, you're the opposite. You're holding up a lot better than I would be in your shoes.
I doubt that. Surprising me, she reached out to touch my cheek, something I could never remember her doing before.
I haven't had to talk you down from a water tower, have I?
Thanks to the coffee and Marge's early morning help, I felt a bit better than I had the day before when I drove London to school. She chattered away in the back seat about her dream, something about a frog that kept changing colors every time it hopped, and her innocent cheer was exactly what I needed. Back at home, I forced myself to put on my running gear. I hadn't run since Vivian's announcement, the first days I'd missed since I'd started back up, and I hoped that the physical exertion would leave me feeling more like myself. On the run, I was fine despite adding a couple extra miles, but by the time I'd finished my shower, I found myself thinking about Vivian again. The fury I'd felt earlier had diminished, replaced by an overwhelming sadness. It was almost too much to bear, and knowing I couldn't face yet another day like the two I had just weathered, I had to do something, anything. My desire to work was zero, but I forced myself to go to my den. As soon as I took a seat at the desk and saw a photo of Vivian, I knew that staying at home wasn't going to work. There were too many reminders here, too many reasons for the emotional train to start steaming again. It was time, I thought, to visit my office. Packing up my computer, I went to the office I'd rented. The shared receptionist was startled to see me, but reported as usual that I had no messages. For the first time, I honestly didn't care. I unlocked my office. Nothing had changed since I'd last been here. It had been weeks, and there was a thin sheen of dust on my desk. I set my computer on it anyway and opened my email. Dozens of messages, most of them receipts for automatic bills or spam. I deleted as much as I could and filed the bills in the appropriate folders until I was left with the emails containing links to the footage for the commercials. With the presentation for the plastic surgeon already complete, it was Taglieri's turn. I reviewed the notes I'd taken the weekend before. Of the 6 takes we'd made in front of the courthouse, 3 were definite no-goes. Of the 3 that were workable, I eventually whittled that down to 2. Of those, I thought he was better in the beginning in the second take, and better at the end in the first take. With a little editing, I had basic software on my computer, I'd be able to put those 2 sections together. There's nothing quite like movie magic. Even better, I liked him in the footage we'd shot, and I was sure that others would as well. He came across exactly the way I hoped, honest, competent, and likable. But more than that, he looked good on camera. Maybe it was the natural lighting, but it was a vast improvement over his previous commercials. The footage for the second commercial was much more complicated. There were a lot of different scenes shot from varying angles, and a particularly gorgeous scene of a meadow with grazing horses, along with many different people, and that multiplied the way the commercial could eventually play out. Knowing it would take more time and energy than I'd be able to summon, I decided to simply work on the first commercial. The software I used wasn't commercial grade, but that was okay. I'd already spoken to the best freelance editor in town, and slowly but surely I got to work. At lunch, I had to force myself to finish a bowl of soup I picked up from the deli, then went back to editing until it was time to pick up London from school. It had not been an easy day. Whenever my concentration waned, even for a second, the emotional turbulence and questions would return. I'd get up from my desk and pace. Other times I would stand near the window, feeling as my chest grew tight and hands began to shake in what seemed to be an airless office. I would feel, deeply feel, my own loss in a way that made me believe there was no reason to go on. But inevitably, because distraction was my only hope of salvation, I would return to the desk and try to lose myself in the service of Taglieri.
"What you're experiencing is normal," Liz assured me on the back patio later that night, after I told her what I was going through. She and Marge had shown up at my house yet again after work. Marge had brought Play-Doh and was sitting on the floor with London while they sculpted various items. "You've suffered a profound shock. Anyone would be upset."
"I'm worse than upset," I admitted. "I can barely function." While Liz and I had talked hundreds of times, it was the first time I ever felt that I needed to talk to her. The day had left me spent. I wanted nothing more than to run away or find a dark, quiet place to hide, but with London, I couldn't do that. Nor did I think it would help. After all, I would carry my thoughts with me wherever I went.
"But you told me you went to work," she said. "You got London to and from school and piano, and she's eaten."
I picked up fast food on the way home.
"That's okay. You've got to learn to be gentle with yourself. You're handling this about as well as anyone could, especially the way you're dealing with the emotions."
"Did you not hear anything I told you?"
"Of course I did, and I know it feels unbearable, but believe it or not, the fact that you're letting yourself feel the emotions instead of suppressing them is a good thing. There's an old saying that goes like this, the only way out is through. Do you understand what I mean by that?"
"Not really. But then again, my brain doesn't seem to be working all that well. The next time I look at the commercial I edited together, I'll be depressed at what a terrible job I did."
"If it's that bad, you'll fix it, right?"
I nodded. I had to fix it. Because Vivian had opened her own bank account, it was up to me to cover all the bills, including, I assumed, the mortgage.
"Good. And that will be another step forward. And as to what I meant earlier, too many people think that suppressing emotions or avoiding them is healthy. And sometimes it can be, especially after the passage of time. But in the immediate aftermath of a traumatizing event, it's often better to simply allow the feelings to surface and to experience them fully, while reminding yourself that the feeling will pass. Remind yourself that you're not your emotions.
I don't even know what that means.
You're sad now, but you're not a sad person, and you won't always be sad. You're angry now, but you're not an angry person, and you won't always be angry.
I thought about what she'd said before shaking my head. I just want to stop the emotions from being so intense. How do I do that?
Keep doing what you're doing. Exercise, work, take care of London. In the end, it's just going to take time.
How much time?
It's different for everyone, but every day you'll feel a little less vulnerable, a little stronger or resolute. If you thought about Vivian every 5 minutes today, maybe next week you'll think about her once every 10 minutes.
I wish I could snap my fingers and be done with it.
You and everyone else who experiences something like this.
Later that night, after London had FaceTimed with her mom and had gone to bed, I continued to sit with Marge and Liz. For the most part, Marge was content to listen. In your experience, I asked, do you think she'll come back?
I've seen both situations, honestly, Liz answered. Sometimes what someone thinks is love is just infatuation, and after the shine wears off, they decide they've made a mistake. Other times it is love, and it lasts. And still other times, even if it is infatuation, the person comes to the conclusion that the love they felt for the first person is no longer there.
What should I do? She won't even talk to me.
I don't know that there's anything you can't do. As much as you might want to, you can't control another person.
I wanted a drink. I wanted to forget and simply not care, if only for a little while. But even though there was beer in the refrigerator, I held off because I feared that once I started drinking, I wouldn't stop until the fridge was empty.
I don't want to control her, I just want her to come back.
I know you do, Liz said. It's clear that you still love her.
Do you think she still loves me?
Yes, Liz said. But right now it's not the same kind of love.
I turned toward Marge.
What happens if she wants London to move to Atlanta with her?
You fight it, hire a lawyer and make a case that she should stay with you.
What if London wants to go?
I felt the pressure of tears beginning to form.
What if she would rather be with her mom?
At this, Marge and Liz were silent.
Friday, I took London to and from school and dance, but otherwise buried myself in work like the day before. I was barely surviving. I remember that 14 years earlier, on a horrible day I would never forget, the Twin Towers collapsed. Then came the weekend. Liz's suggestion had become a mantra. Work out, work, take care of London, and though I wouldn't be heading into the office, I nonetheless wanted to follow her advice. I woke early and ran 7 miles, my longest run in years. I forced myself to eat breakfast and then fed London. While she relaxed, I finished my edits on the first commercial and started working on the second one. I brought London to art class, continued to edit while she was there, and learned that London had made a vase. She carried it to the car gingerly, careful not to bang it on anything.
We have to bring this back next week so that I can paint it, London told me. I want to paint yellow flowers on it, and maybe some pink mouses.
Mouses?
Or a hamster. But hamsters are harder to paint.
I had no idea why that would be, but what do I know?
Okay, flowers and mouses, I said.
Pink mouses.
Even better, I agreed. Are you ready to head to Nana's?
I helped her into the car, knowing that it was time to tell my parents that Vivian had left me. Because Marge wanted to stay with me while I shared the news, Liz took it upon herself to take a walk with London. I called my father in from the garage, and he took a seat next to my mom. I spilled it all in a single rush of words. When I finished, it was my dad who responded first.
She can't leave, he frowned. She's got a kid.
I should call her, my mom interjected. She's probably going through a phase.
It's not a phase. She told me she was in love with him. She's got her own place now.
When is she coming back? My mom asked. If she comes next weekend, your dad and I will be out of town. We're going to visit your Uncle Joe in Winston-Salem. It's his birthday.
My dad's younger brother by a couple of years. Joe was a mechanic who'd never married, but had, over the years, gone through one long-term girlfriend after the next. Growing up, he was the cool uncle, and I can remember wondering why he'd never married. Now I suspect that he might have been onto something. I don't have any idea when she's coming back, I answered.
The work must have been too stressful, my mom said. She's not thinking right.
How is she going to see London? My dad asked.
I don't know, Dad.
Doesn't she want to see London? My dad pressed.
I should really call her,
my mom fretted.
You're not going to call her, Mom, Marge said. This is their business. I'm sure that Vivian will be back to see London, and even though she hasn't told Russ when that might be, I'd guess it'll be within the next week or so. In the meantime, it's probably not the best time to pepper Russ with a ton of questions or to start making plans. As you can imagine, it's been a pretty rough week for him.
You're right, my mom suddenly said. I'm sorry, it's just such a shock, you know?
It's okay, Mom, I said. I watched my dad rise from the couch and walk to the kitchen.
How are you holding up?
My mom asked. I ran a hand through my hair. I'm doing the best I can.
Is there anything I can do? Do you need help with London?
No, I said. I'm doing okay with that. It's not so hard now that she's in school.
Why don't I bring over some dinners for the week? Would that help?
I knew she felt like she needed to do something. That would be great, I said. London likes your cooking a lot more than she likes mine. I felt a tap of cold glass against my shoulder. My dad had a beer in each hand and was holding one out.
For you, he said. I'm in the garage if you want to talk.
When I wandered out to the garage 20 minutes later, my dad motioned for me to sit on a stool while he took a seat on a toolbox. I brought out a second beer for both of us. There was something on my mind, something I hadn't mentioned to either Marge or Liz, and I wanted his perspective.
I don't know if I can do this, I said.
Do what?
Be a single father. Take care of London.
Maybe it would be better if London went to live with Vivian in Atlanta. He cracked open the beer I'd brought him.
I take it you want me to tell you that I'm in agreement with you.
I don't know what I want.
That's not your real problem. Your real problem is that you're afraid.
Of course I'm afraid.
That's what parenting is all about. Doing the best you can while being terrified of screwing up. Kids can turn hair gray faster than anything else, if you ask me.
You and Mom weren't afraid.
Of course we were. We just never let on, is all.
I wondered whether that was true. Do you think I should fight for London, like Marge said, if it comes to that?
My dad scratched at the jeans he was wearing, leaving a streak of grease.
I think you're a damn good father, Russ. Better than I ever was, that's for sure. And I think London needs you.
She needs her mom, too.
Maybe. But the way you've been taking care of her, I know it wasn't easy. But you just got up and did it, and she's a happy little girl. And that's what being a dad is all about. You do what needs to be done and love your kid the best way you can. You've been doing that, and I'm real proud of you. He paused. Anyway, that's what I think.
I tried to recall whether he'd ever said anything like that to me before, but knowing that he hadn't.
Thanks, Dad. You're not going to cry, are you?
Despite everything, I laughed.
I don't know, Dad. Why are you crying?
I wiped at a tear I hadn't known was there.
It doesn't take much these days.
Chapter 15. One Day at a Time. Unlike my friend Danny, I was around to experience my mom's angst as one by one she lost the family with whom she'd grown up. I was 13 when my grandfather died, 18 when my grandmother died, 21 when the first of her brothers passed away, and 28 when the last one slipped from this world to the next. In each case, my mom bore the heaviest burden. All four were lingering deaths, with frequent trips to the hospital while poison was administered in the hopes of killing the cancer before it killed them. There was hair loss and nausea, weakness and memory loss, and pain. Always there was too much pain. Toward the end, there were occasional days and nights spent in the ICU, with my relatives sometimes crying out in agony. My mom was there for all of it. Every night after work, she would head to their homes or to the hospital, and she would stay with them for hours. She would wipe their faces with damp cloths and feed them through straws. She came to know the doctors and nurses in three different hospitals on a first-name basis. When the time came, it was she who helped with funeral arrangements,
and I always knew that despite our presence, she felt very much alone. In the weeks and months following that fourth funeral, I supposed that I thought she would rebound in the way she always had before. On the surface, she hadn't changed. She still wore aprons and spent most of her time in the kitchen when Vivian and I visited. But she was quieter than I remembered. And every once in a while, I would catch her staring out the window above the sink, isolated from the sounds of those of us nearby. I thought it had to do with the most recent loss. It was Vivian who finally suggested that my mom's grief was cumulative, and her comment struck me as exactly right. What would it be like to lose one's family? I suppose it's inevitable in everyone's family. There is always a last survivor, after all. But Vivian's comment made me ache for my mom whenever I would see her. I felt as though her loss had become my loss, and I began swinging by more frequently. I'd drop by after work 2 or 3 times a week and spend time with my mom. And though we didn't talk about what she and I was going through, it was always there with us, an all-encompassing sadness. One night, a couple of months into my new routine, I dropped by the house and saw my dad trimming the hedges while my mom waited on the porch. My dad pretended not to have noticed my arrival and didn't turn around.
"Let's take a drive," my mom announced. "And by that, I mean that you're driving."
She marched toward my car, and after opening the passenger door, she took a seat and closed the door behind her. "What's going on, Dad?" He stopped trimming but didn't turn to face me.
"Just get in the car. It's important to your mom."
I did as I was told, and when I asked where we were going, my mom told me to head toward the fire station. Still confused, I did as I was told. And when we were getting close, she suddenly told me to turn right. 2 blocks later, she directed me to take a left. By then, even I knew where she wanted me to go, and we pulled to a stop next to a gate that was bordered on either sides by wooded lots. Before us stood the water tower, and when my mom got out of the car, I followed her. For a while, she said nothing to me.
"Why are we here, Mom?"
She tilted her head, her eyes seeming to follow the ladder that led to the landing near the top.
"I know what happened," she said, "when Tracy and Marge broke up. I know she was brokenhearted and that you met her here. You were still a child, but somehow you talked her down and brought her back to the dorms."
I swallowed my denials, something easier said than done. Nothing I could say would matter. This was my mom's show.
"Do you know what it's like to think that my daughter might have died here? When she told me, I remember wondering to myself why she hadn't called me or your dad. But I know the answer to that, too. You two share something wonderful, and I can't tell you how proud that makes me. We may not have been the best parents, but at least we raised you both right."
She continued to stare at the water tower.
"You're in so much trouble, but you never said anything to us about where you'd been that night. I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry."
"It's okay," I said. I saw a deep sadness in her expression as she turned toward me.
"You have a gift," she said. "You feel so deeply and you care so much, and that's a wonderful thing. That's why you knew exactly what to do with Marge. You took her pain and made it your own, and now you're trying to do the same thing with me."
Though she trailed off, I knew that more was coming.
"I know you think you're helping, but no matter what you do, you can't take my sadness away. But you are making yourself miserable. And that breaks my heart, and I don't want you to do that. I'm getting through this one day at a time, but I don't have the strength to have to worry about you, too."
"I don't know if I can stop worrying about you." She touched my cheek.
"I know, but I want you to try. Just remember that I've made it through 100% of the worst days of my life so far, just like your dad and Marge, and of course you have, too. And how we get through them is one day at a time."
Later that night, I thought about what my mom had told me. She was right, of course. But what I didn't know was that as challenging as life had sometimes been, the worst days were still yet to come. And they would be the worst of all. 9,360 minutes. That was how long it had been, well, approximately, anyway, since my world turned upside down. And to me, it felt as though I'd been hyper-aware of the passage of every single one of them. Every one of these minutes in the past week I had passed with agonizing slowness, as I seemed to be experiencing them with every cell in my body, every tick of the clock. It was Monday, September 14th. A week ago, Vivian had left me. I continued to dwell on her obsessively, and the night before, I'd had trouble sleeping. Going for a run helped, but by the time I'd returned, I'd lost my appetite. In the last week, I'd dropped another 7 pounds. Stress. The ultimate diet. Even as I made the phone call, I think I already knew what I was going to do. I told myself I simply wanted to know where Vivian would be traveling this week, but that wasn't true. When the receptionist at Spannerman answered, I asked to be connected to Vivian and reached a woman named Melanie, who identified herself as Vivian's assistant. I didn't know my wife even had an assistant, but apparently there was much I didn't know about her, or maybe had never known at all. I was told that Vivian was in a meeting, and when Melanie asked my name, I lied. I told her that I was a local reporter and wanted to know whether she would be around this week to speak. Melanie informed me that Vivian would be in the office today and tomorrow, but after that, she would be out of the office. I then called Marge and asked if she would pick up London from school and later bring her to dance. I told her that I was going to see my wife, but that I would be home later tonight. Atlanta was 4 hours away. I'm not sure how I imagined my surprise visit might go. In the car, one prediction replaced the next. All I knew was that I had to see Vivian. There was a part of me that hoped the hard-edged exterior she offered to me on the phone would melt away in my presence, and we would find a way to salvage our relationship, our family, the life I still wanted to live. My stomach clenched in knots as I drove, evidence of a simmering anxiety that made the drive more difficult than it should have been. Thankfully, traffic was relatively light, and I reached the outskirts of Atlanta at 11:45. 15 minutes later, with my nerves jangling hard, I found the new Spannerman building and pulled into the parking lot. I found a space in the visitor's section, but hesitated before getting out of the car. I didn't know what to do. Should I call her and tell her I was downstairs? Should I enter the building and show up at the reception desk? Or storm past the reception and confront her in the office? The countless variations on our conversation that I had imagined on the drive always began with me sitting across from her at a table in a restaurant, not with the steps that led up to that point. My mind, I knew, wasn't quite up to par these days. Vivian would certainly prefer that I call, that way she could perhaps put me off entirely. For that reason, showing up inside seemed preferable, but what if she was in a meeting? Would I leave my name and sit in the waiting room, like a kid who'd been called in to meet the school principal? I wanted to head straight for her office, but I had no idea where it was, and something like that would cause a scene, which might even be worse. I forced myself from the car as I continued to ponder my choices. All I knew for sure was that I needed to stretch my legs and use the restroom. Spotting a coffee shop across the street, I jaywalked through the stalled traffic to reach the other side. When I left the coffee shop and crossed the street again, I made the decision to call Vivian from the building lobby. That's when I saw them, Spannerman and Vivian in a brown Bentley, getting ready to pull out of the parking lot, onto the street. Not wanting them to see me, I edged closer to the building and ducked my head. I heard the roar of the engine as it finally pulled out, inching its way into traffic. Even though I didn't have much of a plan in the first place, the little I did have was going up in smoke. Despite the lack of appetite, I supposed I could grab a bite to eat and try to catch up with her in an hour or so, which seemed preferable to waiting around, and I started back to my car. Pulling out of the lot, I noticed that the traffic had barely moved and I could still see the Bentley about 8 cars ahead of me. Beyond it, I saw there was some construction going on. An 18-wheeler loaded with steel girders was backing onto a work site, and the traffic on the street had ground to a halt. When the truck cleared the road, traffic started moving again. I followed along, conscious of the Bentley in front of me, watching as it made a right turn. I felt like a spy, or rather a creepy private investigator, when I took the turn as well, but I told myself that since I wasn't going to confront them at lunch or do anything crazy, it wasn't a big deal. I just wanted to know where they were eating. I wanted to know something about the new life my wife was leading. And that was normal, something anyone would do. Right? Nonetheless, I could feel my anger growing. Now there was only a single car between us and I could see them up ahead. I imagined Walter talking and Vivian responding. I pictured the same joyful expression she'd worn when on the phone with him after her argument with London, and my anger transformed into feelings of disappointment and sadness at all I had lost. Why didn't she love me?
They weren't on the road long. They took a left, and then quickly turned into a parking garage beneath a splashy high-rise called Belmont Tower. It had a doorman out front, the kind you see in New York, and I drove on, finally pulling into a restaurant parking lot just up the block. I killed the engine, wondering if there was a restaurant inside the high-rise. I wondered if it was the location of the corporate apartments. I wondered if this was where Walter Spannerman lived. Using my phone, I found the information. Belmont Tower was a Spannerman project, and it was also a video link. I clicked it and saw Walter Spannerman boasting about the building amenities. As his final selling point, he proudly announced to viewers that he'd chosen to live on the top floor. I stopped the video, but like a man choosing to march unassisted to his own execution, I stepped out of the car and made for Belmont Tower. I signaled to the doorman when I was close and he approached. "It's a beautiful building," I said. "Yes, sir, it really is. I was wondering if there's a restaurant in the building, or a dining club for the tenants," I said. "No, there isn't. However, the building has a relationship with La Serna next door. It's a 5-star restaurant." "Are there any apartments for rent?" "No, sir." I put a hand in my pocket. "Okay," I said. "Thanks for your help." A few minutes later, dazed at the idea that Vivian had most likely gone with Spannerman to his penthouse, I was in my car and on my way back to Charlotte. I arrived half an hour after London got back from school, and when I opened the door, she came running.
"Daddy, where were you?"
"I had to work," I said. "I'm so sorry I couldn't pick you up."
"That's okay. Auntie Marge was there. She drove me home."
She put her arms around me.
"I missed you."
"I missed you too, baby."
"I love you."
"Ditto," I said.
"What does ditto mean?"
"You say ditto when you want to say the same thing. You said I love you, so I said ditto, meaning I love you."
"That's neat," she said. "I didn't know you could do that."
"It's just a crazy world, isn't it? Did you learn anything fun in school?"
"I learned that spiders aren't insects. They're called arachnids."
"You mean arachnid?"
"No, Daddy, arachnid, with an M."
I was pretty sure she was wrong, but she'd figure it out eventually. "That's cool."
"It's because insects have 6 legs and spiders have 8 legs."
"Wow, you're pretty smart, you know that?"
"But I still don't like spiders. I don't like bees anymore either, even though they make honey. But butterflies are pretty."
"Just like you. You're pretty too. Prettier than any butterfly," I said. "Can I go say hi to Auntie Marge for a minute?"
"Okay. I have to check on Mr. and Mrs. Sprinkles. Did you remember to give them water?"
"Oops. No, I didn't. But they had plenty yesterday. I'm sure they're okay."
"I'll go make sure."
I kissed her cheek and put her down. She ran toward the steps and vanished from sight. Marge, I noticed, had been watching us from the kitchen. "You're a good dad, you know that?" she said when I reached her. "I try. How was she?" "You mean in the hour I've had her? I had to drive her home and get her a popsicle. And then Mom showed up with a ton of food and I had to deal with that too. I put some in the refrigerator and some in the freezer, by the way. Let's just say that you really owe me for this one. I'm exhausted. What a day. I'm not sure I can take any more." My sister had a flair for sarcastic melodrama, obviously. "I didn't think I'd be back so soon." "Neither did I. And when you did get home, I thought you'd resemble a pile of mashed potatoes. What happened? Was she even there?" "I saw her," I said. "Well, kind of." I told her what had happened. While I spoke, she poured 2 glasses of ice water and handed one to me.
"Can I ask a question?"
"Go ahead."
"Why didn't you just wait for her?"
"After they went to Spannerman's place, I realized I didn't want to see her after that."
"Because?"
"She was with him, probably at his penthouse or whatever, and..."
"And what? She left you. She told you she was in love with him. You do know she's sleeping with him, right?"
"I know that," I said. "I just don't like to think about it. I don't want to think about it." Marge offered a sympathetic expression.
"That makes you perfectly sane."
I hesitated, realizing I was utterly exhausted. "What am I going to do?"
"You're going to take care of yourself, and you're going to continue to be a good father to London.
I mean about Vivian.
For now, let's just worry about you and your daughter, okay?"
I never should have gone to Atlanta. On Tuesday, I tried to bury myself in work on Taglieri's commercial, but it was hard to stay focused, and I thought endlessly of Vivian.
I would see her in the Bentley, Spannerman in the seat beside her. Whenever I imagined her expression, it was the same one I'd seen on the patio. Those images haunted me, bringing with them a sense of inadequacy, of inferiority. I hadn't simply been rejected. I'd been replaced by someone wealthier and more powerful, someone who had the ability to make Vivian laugh and smile in a way that I could not. She had left me, not for reasons of her own, but because of me. I said as much to Marge on the phone the following day, and when she wasn't able to talk me out of my funk, she and Liz showed up at my home after work. It was Tuesday night, and I'd fed London one of the meals my mom had made. As soon as they walked in the door, Marge and London headed off to watch a movie in the family room, while Liz and I sat on the back patio. I recounted everything that had happened and the way I'd been feeling. When I was finished, Liz brought her hands together.
What did you think would happen if you talked to Vivian?
I guess I was hoping that she'd make the decision to come back, or at the very least we'd discuss how we could work it out.
Why?
Has she given you any indication that she wants to come back, or try to work it out? No, I admitted. But she's my wife. We've barely spoken since she left.
I'm sure the two of you will have a sit-down when she's ready, but I can't promise that you'll like what she tells you.
It wasn't that hard to read between the lines. You don't think she'll come back, do you?
I'm not sure my opinion is any better than anyone else's, or that it's even relevant.
You're right. It's not relevant. But you've seen situations like this before, and you know Vivian. I'd still like to know what you think. She exhaled.
No, she finally said. I don't think she's coming back.
I wanted numbness. I didn't want to feel or think about Vivian, but it seemed that the only time I could find oblivion was in the hours that London was in school, when I buried myself in work. On Wednesday, I continued to bury myself in Taglieri's second commercial before finally sending it off to the editor for polishing and finalizing. After that, I worked on the presentation for the surgeon on Thursday afternoon. I was proposing a different campaign than I'd recommended for Taglieri, a much higher online presence and user-friendly website, a heavy emphasis on patient testimonials on video, direct mail, social media, and billboards. And even though I was far less than 100% during the presentation, I left the meeting the following day with a handshake agreement knowing I'd landed my second client. Like Taglieri, he'd committed to a year of services. With those two clients, I realized that I'd replaced nearly half of my previous salary, not counting bonuses. It was enough to meet my monthly obligations with a few trims here and there. It made it significantly easier when I picked up the phone and canceled our joint credit cards. I let Vivian know via text. Vivian called me later that night. Since my ill-advised adventure in Atlanta on Monday, I'd allowed London to answer the phone as soon as I saw Vivian's image pop up on the screen. London let me know that Vivian would be calling me back later. As she headed up the stairs to get ready for bed, I wondered whether she'd figured out that things had changed between her mother and me, or that we were no longer going to be a family. While I waited for her call, I didn't want to get my hopes up, but I couldn't help it. I would imagine hearing her apologize or say that she was coming home. And yet, like the turbulence of my emotions, those thoughts would be replaced with the memory of what Liz had told me. Or that the only reason Vivian was calling was because I'd canceled the credit cards, and she wanted to let me know how angry she was. The push and pull left me exhausted, and by the time the phone finally did ring, I had little emotional energy to expend, no matter what she might say. I let the phone ring four times before finally connecting the call. "Hi," I said. "London said you'd be calling."
"Hi, Russ," she said.
Her voice was calm, as if nothing had changed between us at all.
"How are you?"
I wondered if she really cared or was simply being polite. I wondered why I felt the need to try to read her instead of letting the call simply unfold. "I'm fine," I forced out. "You?"
"I'm okay," she said. "London sounds like she might be coming down with a cold."
She didn't say anything to me.
She didn't to me either. I could hear it in her voice, though. "Make sure she's taking her vitamins and maybe get her some orange juice in the morning. She'll probably need some children's cold medicine, too."
"How can she get a cold? It's almost 90 degrees outside."
"She's in school. New kids, new germs. It happens in every school at the beginning of the year."
"All right," I said. "I'll have to run out to get some orange juice and the medicine, but she's been taking her vitamins."
"Don't forget," she said. "And anyway, I was calling for a couple of reasons. First, I'm coming to Charlotte this weekend. I really miss London, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to spend some uninterrupted time with her."
but not me.
Of course, I said, keeping my voice steady. She'd love that. She misses you too.
Good. Thank you.
I could hear her relief and wondered why she'd anticipated any other reaction.
But here's the thing. I don't think it's a good idea for me to stay in a hotel. I think that would be very strange for her.
I frowned. Why would you stay at a hotel? You can stay at the house. We have a guest room.
I think she'd notice if I slept in the guest room. Even if she doesn't notice, I don't think we should put her in the position where she asks the three of us to do things together. I would really like it to be just the two of us, for her sake, so she doesn't get confused.
What are you saying?
Would you mind staying with your parents, or maybe with Marge and Liz, on Friday and Saturday night?
I could feel my blood pressure spike. You're kidding, right?
No, Russ, I'm not. Please. I know I'm asking a lot, but I don't want to make things any harder on London than they already are.
Or maybe, I thought, you'd rather it not be any harder on you. I let the silence crackle between us. Yeah, I finally said. I guess I can ask Marge. My parents are going to be out of town.
I'd appreciate it.
Remember that London has dance on Friday night and then art class on Saturday morning, so you probably won't have time to do yoga.
I've always put my daughter first, Russ, you know that.
You've been a great mom, I conceded. Oh, for art class, you'll need to bring the vase she made last week. This weekend she'll be painting it.
Where is it?
I put it in the pantry, top shelf on the right.
Got it, she said. Oh, one last thing.
Yes?
I was wondering if you had time for a late lunch tomorrow, around 1:30. We need to talk before I have to pick up London from school.
Despite everything, I felt my heart skip a beat at the thought of sitting across the table from her, of seeing her. Of course, I said. Where? She named a place we both knew, a place we'd eaten many times before, including, once, on our anniversary. I hung up the phone, wondering if it was an omen.
Of course you can stay with us, Marge said into the receiver.
I'd just returned from the grocery store and was putting the orange juice into the refrigerator before calling her.
You'll have to promise not to walk around in your droopy underwear or drink your coffee at the table without a shirt on, though. In fact, don't even pack any droopy underwear, okay?
Do you even know me?
Of course. Why do you think I'm pointing these things out?
I promise.
We won't be around on Saturday, though. You'll be on your own. A friend of ours is having a housewarming party.
No wife, no London, no parents, and now no sister to see on the weekend. I wondered when the last time was that I was utterly on my own, figuring it had been years since something like that had happened. No worries. I have work.
I'll still call you just to make sure you're okay. But back to Vivian, are you sure lunch is such a good idea?
Why wouldn't it be?
Whenever someone says, we need to talk, it's never a good thing.
Believe me when I say I'm not expecting much.
I'm glad, she said. You remember what Liz said, right? She's not going to tell you that she wants to come back.
Liz told you what we talked about?
Of course not, she said. But I know you, and it's not too hard to figure out what you might ask her. And because I know her, I also know what she told you.
It's not as if the two of us haven't had a million discussions about what's going on.
It's been a hot topic around the old homestead these days.
There are better things for the two of you to discuss than my marriage.
And you'd be right 99% of the time, she said. But lately, we're definitely in that pesky 1%.
What else are you saying to each other?
We talk about how much you're hurting, and that we don't know what to say or do to make it better. You're such a good man, such a good father. It isn't fair.
I couldn't help but choke up a bit. You don't have to worry about me.
Of course I do. Big sister, remember?
I hesitated. Do you think Vivian is struggling?
I'm sure she is. You can't do what she did and not feel at least a little bit of guilt. But I'm not sure she dwells on her feelings the way you do. My sense is that you two are just wired differently.
That made sense. But I still care about her, I offered. She's been a wonderful wife. Marge breathed into the receiver.
Are you sure about that?
Vivian had been right about London. When she woke Friday morning, her voice had a raspy edge to it, and on our way out the door, she began wiping at her nose. I wondered how long it would take for the medicine to kick in.
After drop-off, I tossed some clothes in a duffel bag and drove to the office. Still no phone calls for the Phoenix agency. But on the upside, the receptionist was getting used to my presence and had even started saying, "Good morning, Mr. Green." I spent most of the morning working with my tech guy. Together, we discussed and made decisions on